Hey, that idea will never work atmosphere. Discourages innovation that could help a struggling company or one in a challenging business create new products, develop more efficient ways of doing business, or simply survive and thrive. When a workplace becomes adversarial, people do not feel the need to share ideas. Harvey ran a bookstore in a mid-sized Midwestern city. For a brick-and-mortar bookstore to remain successful today, it has to compete not only with online sellers, but with other brick-and-mortar retail that offers interesting experiences for shoppers as well. Harvey's employees, who loved books and also wanted to keep their jobs and serve their community, which was attracting more and more young people and millennials, had loads of ideas about how to draw new customers to the store and keep them coming back. One employee, Hannah, recommended installing inexpensively built walls that would create cozy and quiet spaces in which to dip into books and feel cocooned, combined with more open spaces where people could sit together and hear authors and others talk about a variety of subjects. This event space in the middle of the store could also host poetry slams, movie nights, wine or food tastings, and other events to draw both new and current buyers into the shop. This idea was proven, as it had worked in other bookstores that were staying in business and busy. Another employee, Frank, had ideas about how to make the exterior of the store buzz with activities, including outdoor bookstalls and sidewalk tables in nice weather. He wanted to add eye-catching displays at the entryway. Frank thought Harvey should embrace what was happening in the technology side of the book business and celebrate it by installing a self-printing kiosk in the store so buyers could order books the store did not have room to shelve. A rare and old book section would encourage a different kind of browser and buyer. These were all great ideas that would not cost much money. Harvey dismissed all of them and insisted he was going to do business as he always had. After a few months, both Hannah and Frank left the store and went to work for someone else who welcomed their ideas. A few months later, Harvey was forced to have a going-out-of-business sale and close the store. Tragic and completely avoidable. The ego and temptation. Just one more time won't hurt me. This egocentric lie is so tempting and self-indulgent, it's hard to say no to it. Try to, because just once can turn into forever very quickly, and that can screw up your chances of doing what needs to be done. Just once is the flip side of procrastination. Instead of putting off doing something that helps us, we do something that hurts us. It's an easy trap to fall into, because while just one more time may be technically true, very few of us can actually hold to that promise. Sure, one piece of cake at the wedding won't hurt your blood sugar or waistline. However, one piece of cake often turns into cookies, crackers, candy, soda, and pie with whipped cream on top for the rest of the week, month, and year. One helping of chips, one missed trip to the gym, one night spent vegging out in front of a bar rescue marathon, just once, can turn into too many broken promises. Your brain knows it can get away with this excuse next time, too, and the time after that, and so on, until you are giving yourself insulin shots and using the motorized shopping cart at Walmart. When I talk about temptation, I'm talking about the kinds of behaviors that allow us to get up in the morning and function, but don't allow us to reach our full potential. I'm not qualified to talk about serious addictions to substances. That's a different matter. And if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, you need to deal with it before you think about anything else. When I'm talking about limiting behaviors, I think about the ski bum who can't resist one more trip down the mountain, but never gets his shit together to actually act on his dream of having a ski shop. The habitual gossip who never gains anyone's trust, so she is forever passed over for promotions and lucrative assignments. The slacker who constantly blows off deadlines in favor of taking vacations, and as a result, stay stuck in the same job for years. If you recognize some of your own traits in these examples, I can help you by helping to change the way you think. Quit for a higher purpose. Unfortunately, many of us don't realize that the thing we can't resist has become a negative habitual behavior that hurts us, even if it gives us an emotional boost in the short term. Breaking bad habits is twofold. First, you have to become self-aware enough to understand what behaviors are damaging your credibility and limiting your ability to get things done. And second, You have to find a reason beyond yourself to stop doing them. It's time to both look in the mirror and be honest with yourself. What behaviors are holding you back, and who else is being affected by them? If you don't break these habits for yourself, do it for your family and your friends. Considering the negative impacts on your own future as well as on that of your loved ones may help you to resist temptation. Take people who are trying to quit smoking. Smoking can have a deleterious effect on your success. Aside from the physical damage it does to your internal organs, it can cause premature deterioration of your physical appearance, adversely affect fertility, and can also affect your job prospects. According to a study in JAMA Internal Medicine, smokers remain unemployed longer than non-smokers, and they earn substantially less when they are hired. To help determine whether smoking may actually prevent people from getting jobs, the researchers surveyed 131 unemployed smokers and 120 unemployed non-smokers with follow-up surveys 6 and 12 months later. After a year, only 27% of smokers had found jobs, while 56% of non-smokers had been hired and were working. The smokers who had found jobs earned, on average, $5 less an hour than non-smokers. Still, those reasons may not be enough to get you to toss the pack in the trash. Before my daughter was born, I smoked several packs of cigarettes a day. In 1985, a couple of weeks before her due date, I was sitting in my office, hacking and coughing. It was disgusting. I started to think, is this the kind of behavior I want to model in front of my daughter? I put that cigarette out and never smoked again. Right after my daughter was born, I bought a novelty item, a cigarette and a match in a little glass tube that was labeled "In an Emergency" on the front. I carried the tube in my pocket for 2 months. Anytime I thought about smoking, I would take it out and look at it, and look at a picture of my daughter. Which one is more important, I'd ask myself, and then I'd wind up putting the tube back in my pocket. My discipline and willpower are not perfect, yet the inspiration to quit smoking came from a higher purpose. I had to do it for my daughter. It was more important to my ego, my sense of self, to do something right for my daughter and me than it was to continue to enjoy the sensation smoking gave me. Ultimately, I did not want her to grow up seeing me smoke. I used this higher reason thinking on Bar Rescue often. If you don't want to stop doing something that is hurting you and your business and your family for your own sake, then do it for your kids, your spouse, your future, and their future. This generally gets people to pay attention. When we can find a higher calling, we can achieve a higher purpose. While I could never manage to quit smoking for myself, I could do it for my daughter. Mike is a terrific guy who lives in my neighborhood. In almost every area of his life, as a father, an entrepreneur, a coach to his son's baseball team, a sibling, and a son, Mike is a champ. But he's also a guy who had been trying to reverse his type 2 diabetes for years. He took a ton of medication, but his diabetes stuck around. He tried to cut back on sugar and other trigger foods, but he had a tough time doing it. It was always, oh, I'll just have one piece of bread with lunch, or an ice cream on the weekend won't hurt. Of course, the ice cream and the bread and the snacks and the candy were all hurting Mike. One day, Mike had a wake-up call. He met a man who had kidney disease, in this case as a direct result of his diabetes. Mike had young children at home. He could not risk becoming incapacitated or dying, leaving his wife all alone to care for their family. So Mike became a person who doesn't. In his case, he was a person who doesn't eat processed carbs or sugar. Until he realized his children might have to grow up without him, Mike wasn't interested in really trying to end his negative food habits. The change in his diet actually reversed his type 2 diabetes, and today he is off the meds. He feels better, is more engaged with his family and his job, and is optimistic every day. Help yourself. Compulsive, damaging behaviors are found in people from every demographic and in all industries. "I can't resist" is a lousy excuse for not getting yourself together. I believe you can change. I believe you can turn a page and replace a bad habit with a good one. Be accountable. Mentors, or the buddy system, is one of the best ways to keep your own promise to beat bad habits. The well-known Framingham Heart Study found that people were much more successful at quitting smoking when it was done with other people and when friends and family members were around to keep quitters responsible. There are people in my life who are important and help me not only to work through problems, but also to stay focused on what's important. Writer and producer Kevin Undergaro and his partner broadcaster Maria Menounos, whom you met earlier, are two of my best friends. My wife Nicole and I get together with them frequently to talk about business, our lives, television, and the media. We have so many things in common, as we are all in television and are constantly trying to come up with new media ventures. That means we can be great sounding boards for one another. That's really important. Friends and mentors whom you can talk to openly keep you honest. Mentors, as Kevin and Maria are for me, should be able to tell you when you are doing something that's not working in your best interests. Don't underestimate your family, especially your spouse or life partner if you have one. Couples can sometimes shield each other from problems, but then we miss out on the benefit of the support we could give each other and the honest insight into our behaviors and how they affect those around us. We have to pull those people more deeply into our lives. One of my greatest mentors is my wife. She may not know as much as I do about the hospitality business or the television business, but she knows me very well. She may be much younger than me, but her life experiences, combined with her understanding of how my mind works, gives her a great perspective. Her advice and insights are extremely valuable to me. She will also tell me if my habits are getting in my way. That's a gift. Your greatest mentor might be right next to you on the couch. Let that person in. Keep track. Making note of your behavior is a great way to see patterns. When I rescue a bar, it is easy for me, as an outsider and a professional, to see an owner or staff member's destructive patterns almost right away. However, when you're deep into your own bullshit, you can be blind to the times when you slip up and when you repeat behaviors in response to certain triggers. For instance, if waiting online triggers your temper, you have to either find a way to avoid long lines or figure out something you can do as a distraction from the waiting, like reading something interesting on your smartphone or even playing a digital game. I also recommend getting a notepad to start keeping track of yourself. I suggest keeping a record for at least a week, but 2 would be even better, either at the end of each day or, if possible, while the behavior is happening. When do you engage in your negative habitual behavior? When you feel out of control, as in waiting on a long line? When you're bored, angry, tired? Once you've done that, you can look at your behavior, and you will see patterns, I guarantee it. Once you understand when and why your bad habits get the better of you, you can take action to redirect your ego and your behaviors. Intellectually, you may know that smoking is bad for your health. Overeating can lead to chronic diseases. Getting angry at store clerks doesn't make you feel better. And drinking and taking drugs can royally screw up your life. However, seeing it in writing has power. Alexandra had a demanding and stressful job managing an international law firm in Manhattan. These kinds of firms are often open 24 hours a day. Not only did Alexandra manage the office during the 4 p.m. to midnight shift, she was also in charge of the day and overnight managers. That meant she had to ensure that a team of lawyers in 5 countries were happy, the office ran smoothly, and the other managers had what they needed to do their shifts. She medicated herself throughout her shift with food from the local deli, the pastry cart, and the vending machines in the lobby of the building where the firm was located. In 3 years' time, she was 40 pounds overweight, diagnosed with sleep apnea, and completely exhausted all the time. Her job performance slipped, and the partners in the firm noticed, not to mention her 2 managers. The only person who had the nerve to confront me was the lead lawyer in the New York office, says Alexandra. He told me, look, you have to figure out how to get back to your high performance levels, otherwise we're going to have to either demote you or fire you. The fact that he was so candid was a gift, because without that stern and serious warning, I just would have continued on my way down the sugar drain. Alexandra went to a cognitive behavior specialist and started keeping a food journal. She wrote down the times when she ate extra food, food that was not part of a meal. I got so sick of writing, my hand hurt, she says. It didn't even take her a week to see that she was grabbing snacks 4 or 5 times a day while at work, and even more frequently when she was at home. Alexandra noticed other patterns, too. I rarely wrote down the word hunger. In fact, I don't think I ever wrote it down. I usually wrote down tired or anxious as reasons for my eating. Working with a therapist helped Alexandra come up with healthier alternatives to her behavior. If I felt anxious and wanted to eat, I would stop and think about why I was anxious. If I needed help with work, I would ask for it instead of eating a donut. She also got her sleep apnea checked out and was given a CPAP machine, which she says really changed her life. It took several months, but after about a year of cognitive therapy and changing her eating habits, Alexandra was down to her fighting weight and sleeping better. Her work performance went back to its previous stellar level. Once she started tracking her behavior, thanks to the intervention from that law firm partner, she was able to have control over her temptations. One of the other strategies that helped Alexandra get rid of her food thoughts was to say to herself, sometimes as a whisper and sometimes just in her mind, "I'm not interested in that anymore," or "I don't need that food." There were times when she had to say those phrases to herself hundreds of times a day. But it worked, she says. Bullshit Buster, Brad Bohannon. Brad Bohannon may be one of the most memorable bar owners who appeared on Bar Rescue. His bar, Spirits on Bourbon, formerly Turtle Bay, is now a huge draw for locals and tourists alike in New Orleans. Of all the Bar Rescue subjects, Brad has been the best marketer. He has taken what we did on the show and used it to create a huge platform. He outmarkets everyone around him through events, public speaking, social media campaigns, and innovative products. And that is why he has been so successful. Brad was able to make it in New Orleans despite being an outsider, which is rare. He moved to town as a newlywed, as his wife was finishing her undergraduate work at Louisiana State University. Throughout his own college career, he had worked at Marriott Hotels. Brad started as a doorman at a bar and restaurant, and subsequently worked his way up in a bar business on Bourbon Street in New Orleans. When I was working, I was hustling. I tended bar, and then became the manager. I was very frugal, and I worked every day, open to close. Eventually, Brad saved enough to put his wife through law school and help her open her own practice. He then had the opportunity to become a partner in a business on Bourbon Street with the people for whom he had been working. He took out a large business loan, and because of that, he became millions of dollars in debt. This was a huge obligation. So the business that the loan was based on had to be a success in order to pay back the loan. Then, in 2005, Hurricane Katrina hit. Brad was in Missouri during the storm, trying to figure out what would happen to the business. I was in my brother's basement in Missouri, watching the city fall apart, thinking, what do I do now? Am I going to work at Applebee's as a waiter? When he returned to New Orleans, Brad was able to fix the moderate damage done to the bar and open it right away. "We were the first business to reopen in the neighborhood," says Brad. "We were serving soldiers who had been called in to secure the area. We were the first business on Bourbon Street to have guests." Unfortunately, more trouble was on the horizon. "The people I worked for and partnered with had become like parents to me," Brad says. "However, there was never a point where I didn't think it would go bad, because I had observed over time that all their relationships went bad. I knew that." Brad acknowledges that it was a risk to go into business with the couple, but his ego told him he could overcome the problems he had seen them have with other people. This is a common mistake. We often think we are the ones who can change a person, when ultimately people can change only themselves. "They were having issues sharing the money with me, and then we had a fire in one of the bars," Brad says. "That gave them an opportunity to get him out of the business. The partners went into litigation, and Brad was happy with the settlement. He walked away from his first business with his freedom and its best manager, Steve Smith. Lesson learned." After that, Brad opened a place on his own, in a space that was right across the street from the bar owned by his former partners. "It was very hard because of my relationships with the people I had worked so hard for and had been so successful with. They tried to stop me from building the bar and tried to push me out with legal maneuverings that didn't work," he says. "When that happened, all I could think about were ways to make them fail." That thinking was a problem for Brad, and something we had to work on. He was hurt by what the couple had done to him, and instead of working on making his business a success, he was working on finding ways to hurt their business. His ego was getting the better of him and his business prospects. One day I took a walk with Brad down Bourbon Street and talked to him about this problem with his wounded ego. "Brad, the best revenge is being successful," I said. "You have to stop trying to hurt them and focus on building your business and making it the most successful business it can be." Brad took that advice, shifting his focus from things he could not control, like other people's businesses, and got to work on his own success. We cleaned up the kitchen and made sure the gumbo the bar was producing was made from fresh ingredients. We created a blue drink called Resurrection, which has now become part of the destination status of the bar, meaning people come to the bar specifically to have that drink. A vintage barber chair in the main room is also a draw. Once Brad shifted his focus and started to work on his business, his revenues increased and the consistency and quality of his bar's products went way up. I have yet to meet another bar owner who throws himself so totally into making his business work quite the way Brad does. He is always innovating, making improvements, maintaining consistency and quality, and looking for new ways to bring attention to his bars, whether it's through public and motivational speaking or through robust social media efforts. It's incredible to see someone take some basic tools and use them to his full advantage. Bullshit Buster, Sean Al-Bawab. I first encountered the State Pub, spelled ST8. In Englewood, Colorado, in the Season 7 premiere of Bar Rescue. The manager, Sean Al-Bawab, had basically been handed the keys to the bar, along with the promise of a potential partnership if he could keep it running smoothly and pay the $2,000 a month rent. What an incredible opportunity for anyone who wants to get into the bar and hospitality business, a dream situation that doesn't come along very often. 13 months into this dream venture, though, Sean had created a nightmare. Not a single rent payment had been made. The bar was diving into oblivion, and Sean, along with his friends, was drinking away the profits every night. When I came on the scene, Sean was $35,000 in debt. The owner gave Sean an ultimatum. In 5 weeks, he had to pay all the money he owed, or he would take back the bar and find another manager. At that point, Sean was down to one employee, bartender Caitlin. His mother paid the rent on this 33-year-old man's apartment and helped keep the bar clean, which isn't saying much, because no matter how many times Pamela swept the floor, she couldn't keep up with the crud in the kitchen, behind the bar, and even in the bottles of liquor and the taps. Further, Sean's apathy and negativity created an unpleasant atmosphere that turned customers and former staffers against him. Even his friends had no respect for him. Sean treated the bar like his own personal playground, and instead of being a prospective owner with a positive attitude, he got hammered every night, abused customers, called former employees names, which is why they quit and he had only one left, and staggered around the kitchen reheating contaminated food. Sean even proudly admitted to drinking more than any customer who had ever come into the place. He isn't an alcoholic. He just treated the bar like his personal man cave. Anyone who interfered with his fun got nothing but attitude from Sean. The first order of business was to ensure that Sean was not drinking on the job. When he was sober, he was a completely different person, responsible, friendly, and on the ball. Unfortunately, as soon as he got to the bar, he started to drink, and he would be completely smashed before happy hour began for customers. He could barely stand up straight when 5 o'clock rolled around, which was stupid and irresponsible. Sean also had to learn gratitude and realize that having a bar owner who was willing to give him the bar if he succeeded in running it and a mother who wanted him to succeed were two advantages many people could only dream about. I brought in a team of experts, as I usually do, and we developed a series of new restaurant items and drinks that would entice customers to the bar, which was fewer than 10 miles from downtown Denver. We ramped up the bar's craft beer offerings and educated his new staff on how to sell the products to customers, whether they were knowledgeable about craft beer or neophytes. My experts taught them how to make great-tasting drinks and food and a clean bar and kitchen. We renamed the pub Downstairs Kitchen and Bar and turned it into a bar version of the greatest man cave basement joint you could dream of. Fun, modern, kitsch, and clean. Downstairs kitchen and bar suited the demographics of the area and played off the kind of place Sean wanted it to be, the ultimate cheesy but contemporary man cave. Mom Pamela agreed to be Sean's buddy and hold him accountable for his behavior and his drinking. Today, Sean pays his rent steadily and is paying back his debt to the bar's owner. He no longer drinks on the job, and he expects his friends to pay for what they order, just like any other customers. Sean has also tried hard to kick his addiction to negativity and apathy, which were the root causes of his failure to be a responsible manager. Our egos can get in the way of so many opportunities. It's like a massive control panel directing how we interpret daily experiences. Our perceptions and reactions are then formed by those interpretations, whether it's through negative self-talk, inaction, or destructive habits. Our egos also want to protect us from hurt and defend against potential disappointment and failure. As a result, we impose limits on ourselves in terms of what we are willing to try and even what we are willing to think about others and ourselves. To fight a powerful ego, remember, be aware of your biases and limits. Ask for help when you need it. Don't let other people determine how you feel, and always ask yourself if what you believe about your own abilities is really true. Put your conscious mind in charge, not your ego. DBY to-do list. Get past thinking you're too anything. I defied the odds of being on TV. Bret Singer defied the odds of being a tall actor, and Reed Birney defied the odds of spending his acting career going unrecognized by winning a Tony after 40-plus years in the business. Countless other people have defied the odds by changing from thinking they were too fill-in-the-blank to realizing it was all in their heads. Harry Bernstein published a best-selling memoir at 96 years old. Be who you are, and let that shine. Flip your script. Self-pity is just a trap, but it's one you can get out of. Make it your business to implement a zero-tolerance policy for your own dark feelings and negative self-talk. Practice being positive, and ask yourself if the things you believe about yourself are really true. Do you have proof? Probably not. If they are true, does it really make a difference? Stop comparing yourself with others. We get into trouble when we use comparisons to deny ourselves the right to take action. Focus on your own successes. Find inspiration through authentic knowledge seeking. Compete with yourself. Look at where you were 5 years or 12 months ago. What has improved? What can you do better? What's the best you've ever done at something? How can you beat your own record? Positive self-tracking is a great way to stay motivated and on task. Help yourself. Just one more time won't hurt me. This egocentric lie is so tempting and self-indulgent, it's hard to say no to it. Start to be accountable for your own behavior. Get a buddy or mentor to help keep you on track. Write down your triggers and notice the patterns of your behavior so you can anticipate and change them. Chapter 6. Excuse number 6. Scarcity. For those who do not live in fear of scarcity, life is unlimited. Jonathan Lockwood Huey, author, trainer, and personal coach. Excuses based on lack of funds or resources, or not having enough. I don't have enough money or resources to succeed. People often cry the no-cash blues to me when they're trying to explain why they can't improve their business or start a new one, or even afford to take a coveted trip or buy a new car. However, when we sit down and really look at their situations, we find that their issues are usually caused by either a misallocation of their resources or not thinking correctly about their assets. I meet so many owners who do not have a clear picture of their financial status and assets that could be turned into cash if necessary. Bar owners have told me they couldn't afford to buy lemons, and then I stepped outside into their parking lots and saw an expensive sports car or other luxury vehicle parked in the owner's spot. No matter how well I have done in life, I never bought a car unless I could put 50% down. You may be strapped for cash right now, and that can be genuinely painful. I've been there. There were times in my career when I had very little money or lost a great deal of money, yet still had to provide for my family. I know from personal experience that there's no reason you need to be stuck in a cash-poor state forever. You can start or turn around a business, pay off a loan, and expand your horizons, even with very little. The key is to take an honest look at the way you choose to spend the money you do have or are taking in. You can start or improve a business with very little money, and that's what I will focus on in this chapter. Don't sell tomorrow for today. Whether you are trying to start a business or working your tail off trying to make ends meet until your next office promotion, you can learn to use money wisely, save money, and make money work for you. If you need money for any reason, and this chapter focuses on those of you who would like to start a business either as a sideline or as a full-time gig, start by making better choices. You may have to sell your car and get a cheaper one. You may have to move to less expensive digs. Costs can be cut without sacrificing quality. Debt can be paid off in reasonable ways, and innovation, product development, and marketing don't have to cost much, or anything, in the right environments and with the right mindset. When you hear yourself saying, "I don't have the money to get started. There is no way I can reduce my expenses. I need to continue earning exactly what I earn now. I can't make any changes until I pay off my debt. I need more savings before I take a risk. I don't make enough money to put any aside. What if I can't make any money at it? I have no safety net. If I fail, I will be left with nothing." It's time to get over your scarcity excuses and stop bullshitting yourself. Just try it. Let's say you have a great idea for a service or a product, such as a smartphone-driven healthy breakfast delivery service or a solar-powered fire pit, but no funds to create samples or prototypes. Sure, it would be nice to have a venture capitalist sweep in and hand you a wad of cash or your Aunt Betty to leave you her fortune, but that's probably not going to happen. However, not having money is no excuse. If you are confident that you have an idea for a business that solves a problem and that people will want, and even if you aren't 100% confident, who is? Don't let the money excuse derail you. Startup costs have decreased in recent years because of the availability of so many low and no-cost tech solutions. Today, creating a professional-looking website is affordable and impressively easy to do. Social media allows you to advertise or distribute your work for virtually nothing. Smartphones make video production a breeze. Old-fashioned footwork, research, and person-to-person selling are still powerful tools when starting a business, and also cost nothing. My grandfather gave me great advice. He said, "The size of your phone book is more important than the size of your checkbook, because great relationships are much more valuable than money." Whom do you know? How can they help you? The people you know may even be your first customers. When I learned about Kale Robinson, I was impressed with her diligence and creativity. She started her company, Live Worldly LLC, with $40 and an instinct about how fashion trends form. In 2007, a friend had given her a wish bracelet. As you put the cloth bracelet on, you were supposed to make three wishes. 6 months after receiving the bracelet, Kale, then 27, lost her job at a public relations firm. At the time, she was also working a few hours a week as a lacrosse coach at a Denver, Colorado high school. After she was let go, she took a planned trip to Argentina, where she noticed many young women wearing wish bracelets similar to the one she had. The observation of their extreme popularity got her thinking. Once home, she bought 100 of the bracelets for $40 from a South American wholesaler. She wore 5 of them to a lacrosse practice and offered them to her team for $250 each. They quickly sold out, so she bought another 100 pieces. The lacrosse team was the perfect demographic because Kale knew fashion trends often start at the teenage level and then move into the larger culture. It wasn't long before Kale had more orders than she could fill. She ordered 1,000 more from her wholesaler and raised the price per unit to $5. Next, she started to cold call local boutiques to see if they would sell her product on consignment. Several agreed. Over time, retailers throughout the state and beyond began to place orders. By the summer of 2008, Kale had earned enough to pay for a professional website and logo for her company. She hired a publicist friend who helped her write and distribute press releases to major magazines catering to her demographic, young and trend-conscious women. Cosmo Girl gave her company its first national attention with a short blurb. Kale used the Cosmo Girl clip to contact higher-end retailers, including Barney's New York, Fred Siegel, and Kitson. She sent each of them a copy of the article, along with 50 bracelets and a glass bowl, ready for display. The stores sold out of the samples within a week and ordered more. The following winter, Kale asked foreign buyers if they had an interest in distributing the bracelets, and many said yes. Within a short time, she expanded her catalog to include other products from around the globe, the unifying principle being some kind of special meaning or cultural significance. She also started an adventure travel company that helps people immerse themselves in the culture of places like India, Bali, and Kenya. As of this writing, her products are available in more than 500 stores worldwide. According to Kale, Live Worldly has made a profit since its inception. It's not a major profit, and Kale lives frugally, watches expenditures, and works on developing her business every day. However, she did not have to go back to office work and managed to make a living doing something she finds exciting and engaging and worthwhile. Kale made an observation. Wish bracelets were popular overseas, and her American lacrosse players seemed interested in them too, and turned that and $40 into an international business. When I had the idea for Bar Rescue, I didn't have the kind of funding that producing a television show or series required, and I was not prepared to put a great deal of my own money into the project. That didn't stop me. Writing a brief explanation of the show's concept and the main players in it cost me nothing but my time. I hired a friend who was a cameraman and a lighting man for about $2,000 to create the sizzle reel. The first title of the show was On the Rocks, but in testing we realized people thought the show was about bad marriages, so we nixed the name. It became Bar Rehab, and then Bars on the Brink. Finally, we landed on Bar Rescue. We sent the package to a production company with a pitch letter, and the people there liked it enough to propose the show to Spike, and the network loved it. I had an idea for a television show, so I put together a package to show producers. Kale had an idea to sell bracelets she had seen on a trip to Argentina. Neither of us, and countless other people who start businesses, agonized over scarcity of funds or resources. We didn't worry too much or question our ability to pay for what we wanted to do. We just started doing it. Our passion was more important than how we'd find the money to get going. Our curiosity and interest, the driving force behind us. Those things do not require a big bank account. If you want to do something, what can you start doing about it today? Whom do you know who can help? Your first customers could very well be your neighbors, friends, and colleagues. Remember, too, that if you are passionate about a business idea and serious about getting it started, lack of funds is quite likely to be a temporary condition. The adage, "Do what you love and the money will follow," has been proven true many times over. It can be true for you, too. Create a plan. When I say create a plan, I don't mean a complex business plan in the formal sense of the word. Most entrepreneurs don't actually have to write an extensive business plan unless they are seeking substantial funding from a venture capitalist or a bank, and for many of you, that is not going to be the case. Microloans and small business loans don't require you to roll out 40-plus page proposals. However, you do have to put your ideas down on paper. Everything I do, I start on paper. Every promotional idea, every market analysis, and every new creative endeavor. I look at it, digest it overnight, and reread and revise the next day. I see what's missing and what doesn't need to be there. Putting things on paper makes ideas concrete. It is worth the time and effort. I want you to create a plan of action and then systematically implement the plan. Frankly, putting an idea down on paper, organizing its moving parts, is the only way you will really know how much, if any, money you need. Whether you're starting a side business and keeping your day job, or going all in and starting from scratch, here's how to get started. 1. Make your idea specific. This needn't be complicated. Write down your idea and describe it. Determine the goal and mission of your company. Why are you different? Who is your audience? Who is going to buy your product or service? Why will your buyer want your product or service? How will you be paid? 2. Give it a name. Naming your business makes it official. Once you have a name, you can secure a domain name for a website, build a free website using WordPress to get started, or use one of the low-cost e-commerce web building sites. Register the business in your state as an LLC or an S-corporation, whichever is appropriate. LLCs have few paperwork requirements and offer some real benefits to a small business, such as personal asset protection and tax advantages. For instance, an LLC can enter into contracts and obtain a loan that will not have an impact on its members' personal assets. Profits and losses of an S-corp pass through to the corporation's owner, which allows you to avoid double taxation. Discuss these options with a qualified accountant. What may sound scary may actually have many benefits for your small business and you. Have business cards made. There are printing companies that provide free business cards in exchange for a small line of advertising on the back of the card. Set up a PayPal account. 3. Give yourself a deadline. 30 to 60 days is a good amount of time for a small startup to put its basic infrastructure in place, particularly if it is a service or a business you can run from remote locations or from home. If you need a brick-and-mortar location, you can find a property to rent within 30 to 60 days, including all the paperwork necessary for utilities. A basic website can be set up within 1 month. 4. Broadcast it. Don't be a nuisance, but give friends, family, colleagues, and other contacts a heads up that you're starting a business. This is your network. They may be able to offer help and support. Send out an email blast to your network. Introduce yourself to colleagues in your area. Let your social media networks know what you're up to. Introduce yourself to local businesses and business organizations, Chamber of Commerce, etc., that could offer support. 5. Work on your business every day. Devote a part of each day to developing your ideas, finding new networks, and creating profitable connections. Identify and reach out to new contacts. Research conferences and educational opportunities that will help evolve your business. Meet with colleagues. Find a mentor or mentoring programs for entrepreneurs. 6. Get creative about funding. There are some types of businesses, particularly those that require brick-and-mortar locations, inventory, and employees, such as retail businesses, bars and restaurants, auto repair shops, healthcare, and some types of services like law firms and real estate, that require funding. You do need capital to rent space, buy equipment and inventory, and hire help. Again, being short on cash is not an excuse to forego starting such a business. You may have to hold off while you raise the necessary funds, but that's not impossible. Here's how. Get a line of credit. There is nothing unusual about a startup using or having access to a line of credit. Many major and local banks and credit institutions offer credit at favorable interest rates that are specifically designed to allow for growth in the early stages of a business. However, you have to have collateral or assets to get a loan and a proven ability to pay back any loan you take. If you do not have income or collateral to support a loan, you may need a partner who does or who can invest in your business. I caution you not to overspend. You still have to live and work frugally. When you use credit, you have to pay it back. It's debt like any other debt. Don't get underwater. Consider using a business incubator. These are organizations that help you grow your business by providing access to office space, management training, angel investors, and contact with economic development groups. One of the greatest incubators, Innovation, Innevation, is located in Las Vegas. It is owned by Rob Roy, CEO and founder of Switch, a data storage technology company and one of the most socially conscious companies I know of. While Innovation does not refer to itself as an incubator, it offers many of the services that incubators provide, such as office space, conference rooms, and networking opportunities. And out of those opportunities, relationships that lead to funding and investments may develop. SCORE is another great resource that provides mentors, advisors, and business consultants to small businesses and entrepreneurs. The National Business Incubation Association has more than 1,400 members in the United States alone. It has a search engine and a directory of state business incubation associations. Other sources for finding the right incubator for your business are state and local economic development offices and local SBA, Small Business Administration, offices. Some business incubators are sponsored by colleges and universities, so if you are near or in a college town, check them out as well. Social media-inspired crowdfunding platforms have changed the way individuals and small businesses can raise money for projects. GoFundMe, Kickstarter, Indiegogo, Kiva, and many others allow individuals to invest small to large amounts of money in return for a variety of types of future buy-ins or stakes. Get ready to work hard and get creative. You have to get in the trenches and make your business happen, especially if you don't have huge funding to hire staff and outsource. The only way to generate revenue is to roll up your sleeves and get to work. Most of the time, this means wearing many hats. In the beginning, you have to be willing to knock on doors, work the booth at trade shows yourself, negotiate your own deals, answer the phones, make your own coffee and lunch, and sweep the floors at night. In short, you might have to be salesperson, lawyer, marketing manager, secretary, cook, and janitor, all in the same day. You'll also have to be smart and creative about money and the things that cost money, like inventory and staff. Here are some tips. Go with the cash flow. Making more money isn't simply about generating revenue. It also means choosing how best to reinvest in your business once you have earned some money. You have to be ruthless about how you spend your time and money. If your budget is restricted, be strategic about spending. I advise moving from front to back. To prioritize, think, invest in the guest. That means if you are on a limited budget, spend the most money on things that guests or clients can see, taste, smell, and experience. Make certain everything a guest or customer touches is as perfect as it can be. For instance, if you are selling a product, buy the best display cases you can afford. If you have an actual brick-and-mortar location, ensure that the exterior and interior are inviting, clean, and attractive. If your office will host clients, make sure the waiting and meeting rooms are spotless, comfortable, and uncluttered. If I need new flooring in the front of my business, I'm going to buy the best I can afford. If I need a new piece of back-office equipment, such as a printer, I will certainly buy one, but it may not be brand new, and it may not look the best, because the customer can't see it. Here are some smart ways to reinvest in your business. Accountant. Without good accounting, a business can get into trouble pretty easily. Even if you are starting to figure out your business and revenues are growing, you can still run out of money faster than you might think and go out of business because you ran out of money. That's what happens to many bars. They get to the point where they are making a little money, but because of mismanagement, overspending, bad planning, it runs out and they can't pay the rent. If they had an accounting system in place that took into account future expenses and could predict fluctuations in cash flow, they might have made it over the hump. Entrepreneurs tend to look at accounting last when they should look at it first. An accountant can help you determine how much you need and when you'll need it, and put a system in place to make sure you hit those targets. Unless you really enjoy doing tax paperwork, such as payroll and tax payments and filings, hire an accounting firm to help make sure you're in compliance and paying bills. The cost is tax deductible. You might be able to do the job adequately, but your time is probably better spent on things you can actually monetize, like acquiring new customers and keeping the ones you have happy. If you screw up on the financial side of things, you could do a lot of damage to your business. In addition, automate as much accounting and bill-paying functions as possible so that you know they are being taken care of without worry. Customers. Customers equal income. Too many small business owners have no structure in place for knowing who their potential customers or clients are and how they think, what they want, where they live, and why they seek out goods or services. Owners have to learn about getting new customers, customer frequency, and how much customers spend. In my experience, you have to generate at least 20% new business every month to mitigate business you lose every month, which is about 20% on average, and sometimes more. Unfortunately, not enough business owners understand how they can get new customers, get those customers to come more often, and then get them to spend more when they come. I've used response cards, which customers fill out on the spot to tell you how you are doing. One problem with these cards is that they offer limited information. People fill them out for two reasons, if they had a really great time or if they had a really bad time. The people who had a mediocre time don't fill out the cards. They just never come back. You have to understand your customers and potential customers to understand how to attract them to your business. There are now programs that help you keep track of how your customer retention programs work, including a few good ones I'll recommend. Find the right one for you, because there are always new sales and consumer tracking programs entering the market. Contactually helps you keep notes on people in your life and reminds you to stay in touch with them. AWeber is an email marketing tool that captures leads and makes sales offers. It lets you know who opened your emails and when, so you have a good idea of audience engagement. Infusionsoft offers sales automation, link tracking, and shopping cart and affiliate management. It's not as inexpensive as other options, but it may save you a couple of hours a day, so it could be worth it if you have numerous contacts that you want to stay in touch with. Knowledge. As I discussed earlier in the book, there are many free sources of information and education. However, there may come a point where you want to meet new colleagues, network, and do in-depth learning on a particular subject. Perhaps you want to get certain certifications that will help you build a higher-end client base or build your reputation or credibility. That education is worth paying for. Hire people you know and trust. If you have any budget at all for extra help, it is a good idea to hire people with whom you have worked before and whom you have complete confidence in to carry out their responsibilities. That way, you won't have to spend too much time training. And when you need to travel or be away from the business for any reason and for any amount of time, you know you'll have trusted staff to hold down the fort while you're gone. Be cautious about family members. Communicate clearly about roles and expectations. Write rules and procedures down in an employee handbook and let people know what you expect of them. If friends tell you they will work for free, be careful and consider paying them something. You have to make it clear that you will still treat them like paid employees. Will they want to work for free if you call them at 2 a.m. with a crisis? Exploit social media. A friend and colleague of mine were talking about social media and how hard it is to monetize followers and likes. Social media can also be a time suck, which is a genuine waste of your money. Understand what social media can do for your specific business, and then focus on platforms that give you real ROI, return on investment. I won't stop using social media, and right now I use Twitter and Facebook to connect with fans, but spending time on it is not how I use my most valuable hours of the day. Social media is always available, so you can work on it during off hours, in the evening, and during downtime. Here is my Social Media 101 primer. Snapchat. 60% of Snapchat users in the United States are under the age of 24, and more than 100 million users consume 30 minutes of content on the site every day. That means it can be a worthwhile place for businesses that target millennials. If you create video content of any kind, Snapchat provides a free marketing opportunity to distribute all sorts of information, including interviews, demonstrations, new collections, performances, and so on. I know of bars and restaurants that use the app to send coupons for special discounts on cocktails and meals. Facebook. The social media powerhouse skews older than other similar sites. American women and men between the ages of 25 and 54 make up 32% and 29% of Facebook users, respectively. A whopping 44% of these people check Facebook several times a day. By contrast, only 9% of users are between the ages of 18 and 24. If your target customer is over 24, create a company page on the site so that you have a presence there. You can provide contact information, information about new products or releases, and you can engage with customers, observe comments, and interact. If you have a business, it should have a Facebook page. My Facebook Bar Rescue page, www.facebook.com/barrescue, allows me to engage with fans, learn what they are thinking, and share news about upcoming programs and events. Instagram. This visual site has 500 million users, and nearly 60% check their accounts daily. Instagram has changed the way its users see information, so it's no longer chronological, but based on a proprietary system that responds to how users interact with the site. Instagram is valuable only as a supplement to your brand-building efforts, and not as a marketing or sales tool. It's fantastic for posting images from your business. For hospitality businesses, it's a natural resource for posting delectable images of creative cocktails and scrumptious dishes to engage and tempt customers. People who sell anything that has an aesthetic component, such as crafts, art, antiques, jewelry, or fashion, should exploit this platform. Pinterest. If you have a large female-based clientele, Pinterest is worth investing time in because 42% of women online are Pinterest users, 34% are between the ages of 18 and 29, and 28% are between the ages of 30 and 49. If you are into food, fashion, art, home decor, antique, pet, or artisan/craft business, Pinterest is a great resource for reaching interested people. It also has a new Pinterest buy button, so you can help customers buy your products from the site. Turn it around. When I was the general manager of a chain of Holiday Inns in the Midwest, I was faced with the responsibility of improving old, outdated restaurants that were attached to the hotels. Turnover was massive at this chain, and every time a new general manager came in, he would order new plates or furniture, but never with any consistency. As a result, there was no cohesive, consistent theme in any property. The only unifying message the restaurant sent was, "We're old, dated, and tired." The hotel franchisor's director of quality control came to me shortly after I started the job. As we toured the properties in the group, I wasn't surprised when he said they were substandard. He was right. They were also losing money. As he was a major player in the hierarchy of the hotel chain, I had to take his criticism seriously. He could pull my sign down and close the restaurants. What was I going to do? I had no money. My budget was limited to what Holiday Inn said I could spend, and it wasn't much. "You have to make things in each restaurant match," the director told me. I looked at my budget, and clearly there was no money to update 6 hotel restaurants. Instead of whining to him and ranting about how broke we were and how impossible it was to make the restaurants look consistent, my team rented a U-Haul and then drove it around the 6 properties and mixed up everything we had even more than it already was, including the dishes and silverware, on purpose. Once I was done, every item was boldly and obviously mismatched in every way. Tables, chairs, glassware, flatware, so it appeared obviously deliberate. It was great. I created a concept based on a rural feel, including calling the restaurant's village marketplace, where nothing matched on purpose. We built old-fashioned-looking carts out of cheap, rough-hewn pine and old wagon wheels, and filled them with hay and fruit. It cost me about $400 for each restaurant, which included the U-Haul rental, materials and labor to build the carts, cleaning, and the time it took to do the switching of furnishings and tableware and the setup. The quality control director came back after the renovation was complete and was stopped in his tracks. "You son of a bitch," he said. "You did it, and I can't argue with it." The moral of the story is that I took a liability where nothing matched and turned it into an asset where nothing matched. When guests came into the restaurants, they could immediately identify the theme and anticipate a friendly, country-style, casual dining experience, and that's exactly what we gave them. Simple comfort food and a charming environment. Employees were happier because they felt they worked for a company that had a distinct mission and vision, so productivity increased. Customers loved the charm of the restaurants, and revenues went up. Doug, a young East Coast entrepreneur, founded a clothing and accessories manufacturing firm in 2005. The company is premised around the idea of cutting-edge custom designs for millennial businesses and their audiences. He saw room for a company that could create beautiful promotional items, like T-shirts and wearable accessories, that were more stylish and contemporary than what was available. It has done work for theatrical productions, television shows, YouTube personalities, and local brick-and-mortar businesses, including food, wine, and clothing stores. Doug's original investment was about $500 of his own money to create T-shirt, cap, and jacket samples to show prospective customers. 2 major orders, one from a local tech company that wanted branded clothing for employees and another from a small chain of local cheese and gourmet food stores, gave him the funding he needed to start his business, which he did, with just 4 employees, friends working together. We all did everything, from packing T-shirts and caps into plastic bags to keeping track of inventory and making deliveries, says Doug. The company grew, and by 2009, Doug had gone from 4 to 35 employees. Even so, revenues were not growing fast enough, and there was an undercurrent of anxiety among employees about the sustainability of the business. Some loyal clients complained about late orders. There was a lack of focus among employees, and everyone came to Doug with the smallest question or decision. Doug says, "We were often working at cross purposes. We did not share a common vision for right now